Nathaniel's eyes narrowed. My answer comes behind you on tiptoed feet. Kill him, Belazael! Strike him down! As he shouted, he pointed back up the stairs. The mercenary ducked, whirled around in readiness, saw the stairs empty. Breathing a curse, he spun again, a silver disc now cupped in his hand, only to glimpse Nathaniel also turning, heading up the passage into the vaults. His arm moved, but disc was gone. Nathaniel had twisted and tried to run in a single, desperate movement. He lost his balance, tripped on a flagstone's edge, and fell. The silver disc flashed through the air, struck the wall above Nathaniel's falling head, ricocheted against the opposite side of the passage, and clattered to the floor. Nathaniel landed on hands and knees. He scrambled to his feet, and scooping up the silver disc, ran on. He snatched a glance behind him. In the distance, the mercenary strode across the chamber floor toward the passage, his face heavy with irritation. He went unhurriedly. About his boots hung pulsing lights and smudges. His first step was three times an ordinary man's. With his second, he was right at Nathaniel's back. He raised his knife. Nathaniel cried out, lurched to one side. From the stonework of the passage, a grey shadow emerged, silent as smoke. A coiling limb entwined itself around the mercenary's waist. An arm looped upon his throat. The man's head jerked back. He raised his knife, slashed out. The shadow moaned, but clung on tighter. A sickly blue radiance emerged from the shadow and enveloped the mercenary. He coughed and spat. Other shadows drifted from the walls and floor, wound themselves around the boots and trousers, grasped the flapping cloak. The mercenary slashed left and right. He tapped a heel. The seven-league boots took wing. In a single step, he was away along the corridor, halting at a junction far ahead. But the blue glow hung about his head. The shadows clung to him like leeches, and still more came hurrying from the stones. Nathaniel leaned against the wall for support. It was the boots, of course. Their aura had triggered the trap as soon as the mercenary entered the corridor. The shadows had immediately set upon their owner. Trouble was, it was a magical attack, and as he knew from bitter experience, the mercenary's resilience to magic was huge. But their intervention had given him respite. The treasure vault was somewhere up ahead, past where the mercenary thrashed and struggled. There was no help for it. Clutching the silver disc gingerly, the edges were very sharp, Nathaniel stole along the corridor, past numerous doors and side turnings, nearer and nearer to the junction. By now so many of the shadows had poured themselves upon his enemy that Nathaniel could scarcely make him out. He was hidden amid a pile of writhing bodies. Their weight alone had forced him to his knees. Occasionally his face, purple behind the beard and the choking radiance, came in sight. He seemed half-throttled, but his knife still flashed about him. Curls of melting essence littered the floor like wood shavings. Silver, too, Nathaniel thought. The knife, they can't withstand it. Sooner or later he'll be free. This unpleasant knowledge spurred him on. He reached the junction. Keeping the disc raised and his back to the wall, he rounded it, watching the combatants the whole time. Even as he did so, one shadow fell away, cut clean in two by a single blow. Nathaniel lingered no longer. He didn't have much time. Down the corridor, dead straight into the earth. There at the end, the steel door with a little grill. The entrance to the treasure vault. Nathaniel reached it at a run. He looked back the way he had come. Distant scuffles, gasps, unearthly moans. Forget the mercenary now. What was he to do? He inspected the door. It was ordinary enough. The hatch with the viewing grill, a simple handle, no other marks or indentations. Might it contain a trap? It was possible. Then again the clerk had not mentioned one. A pestilence guarded the treasures inside, he knew that much. But how was this triggered? Perhaps simply opening the door would set it going. Nathaniel's hand hovered over the handle. Should he? He looked back over his shoulder. It was no good. He had to get the staff. He was dead otherwise. He grasped the handle, turned and pulled. Nothing happened. The door remained fast. Nathaniel cursed and let go. Locked, somehow. He racked his brains. There seemed no obvious keyhole. Some magical hex lock? If so, he'd never find the charm. A foolish thought struck him. He turned the handle again. This time, he pushed. Ah! The door swung open. Nathaniel let it swing. He held his breath. No pestilence bubbled forth. Automatic lights, perhaps from some captive imp imprisoned in the ceiling of the treasure vault, switched on. Everything was as he had seen it 2 days before. The plinth of marble in the centre, piled high with treasures. The otherwise empty room. The wide ring of olive-green floor tiles all around the plinth, stretching almost to the door. Nathaniel rubbed his chin. In all probability, if he stepped upon those green floor tiles, the pestilence would rise up, and in seconds he would perish horribly. The idea was unappealing. But how could he bypass it? The ring of tiles was far too wide to jump. He had no means of climbing above them, and he could not fly. Indecision gripped him. He could not go back. The situation was too desperate, and Kitty was relying on him to succeed. But to enter the room was death. He had no means of defence, no shield or charm. His eyes fixed upon an object lying in the centre of the distant plinth. A jade stone set in a delicate oval of pressed gold. It hung by a chain from a wooden stand. The Amulet of Samarkand. Nathaniel knew very well what it could do. He had seen it repel the power of the demon Ramuthra. It could cope with a little pestilence, all right. What if he ran as hard as he could? He bit his lip. No, the distance to the plinth was much too great. He'd never be able to get to the amulet before... It was not a sound that alerted him. The corridor behind his back was utterly silent. But an intuition, a sudden sharp foreboding that sent prickles along his spine, made him turn. The sight along the corridor knotted his stomach, made his knees weaken. With knife and fist, the mercenary had succeeded in dislodging all but one of the shadows. Fragments of the others lay flopping on the floor around him. New shadows were still emerging from the stonework. One of them fired a blue pulse at the mercenary that knocked him momentarily against the wall, but he did not falter. Ignoring the shadow on his back that sought to throttle him, the mercenary stooped and kicked off first one boot and then the other. They struck the stones, lay on their side. The mercenary stepped away from the boots. Instantly, the shadow's interest in him receded. They flitted about the boots, sniffing and prodding with long fingers. The shadow on his back was distracted. It loosened its grip. A shrug of the back, a swing of the silver knife. Where was the shadow now? Two pieces clawing for each other on the floor. As Nathaniel watched, the mercenary set off up the corridor toward him. He came implacably, but slowly. His cape was tattered. He walked in his socks. The ferocity of the shadow's assault seemed to have weakened him. His face was mauve with exertion. He limped and coughed with each step. Nathaniel stood in the doorway, half in, half out of the treasure room. His head made frantic movements, side to side, green tiles to mercenary. He was sick with panic. He had nothing to decide but the method of his death. He steeled himself. One way, death was inevitable. The expression on the mercenary's face promised him pain. As for the other way... The cool glint of the amulet shone on the plinth across the room, beckoning him over. It was so far. But the pestilence would at least be quick. Nathaniel made his decision. He walked out of the door, away from the treasure room, toward the oncoming mercenary. The blue eyes bored into him. The man smiled. The knife rose. Nathaniel spun on his heels and sprinted back toward the door. He ignored the snarl of rage behind him, focused only straight ahead. It was crucial to pick up speed, hit the green tiles at maximum velocity. An explosion of pain in his shoulder. He cried out like an animal, stumbled but ran on. Through the door, into the room. Green tiles stretched out ahead. Limping footsteps right behind. A muttered cough. The tile's edge. He sprang, leapt through the air as far as he could. Landed. Ran on. All about him, the hiss of a thousand serpents. Yellow-green vapour rose from the tiles. Ahead was the plinth. Treasures gleamed upon it. Gladstone's staff, a jewelled glove, an ancient violin stained with blood, goblets, swords, caskets, and tapestries. Nathaniel's eyes were fixed on the amulet of Samarkand, juddering and jerking with the impact of each stride. Green vapour covered everything in a sallow veil. Nathaniel felt his skin sting. The stinging intensified, became a sudden desperate pain. He smelled a burning. A cough behind him. Something brushed his back. The plinth. His hand reached out, snatched up the necklace, tore it from its stand. He jumped, twisted, fell sprawling upon the plinth, sent jewels and wonders scattering, rolled across, dropped to the tiles on the other side. His eyes burned. He screwed them shut. His skin was afire. At a distance he heard a voice give a scream of agony. It was his own. Blindly he pulled the necklace over his neck, felt the amulet of Samarkand brush against his chest. The pain was gone. His skin still burned, but it was a residual stinging, not an escalating torment, save in his shoulder, where it throbbed with sick intensity. He heard a whispering, opened one eye, saw the vapour coiling all about him, swirling, seeking out his flesh, but being drawn inexorably around and down into the jade stone at the centre of the amulet. Nathaniel raised his head from where he lay. He could see the ceiling, the side of the plinth beside him, the vapour that filled the room. The view beyond was hidden. So where? A cough, just behind the plinth. Nathaniel moved, not fast, but as fast as he could. The pain in his shoulder prevented him putting weight on his right arm. With the left, he levered himself into a crouching position, then slowly rose. On the other side of the plinth, the mercenary was standing, surrounded by the billowing cloud of yellow-green vapour. He still held the knife, his eyes were fixed on Nathaniel, but he leaned heavily on the plinth top and coughed with every breath. Slowly he drew himself up. Slowly he started to walk around the plinth to Nathaniel. Nathaniel backed away. The bearded man moved with the utmost care, as if his limbs pained him. He ignored the boiling pestilence which ate away his cloak, which bit into his black clothes, into the thick black socks upon his limping feet. Nathaniel's back bumped against the wall at the far end of the chamber. He could go no farther. His hands were empty. He had dropped the silver disc somewhere as he ran. There was no defence now. The pestilence swirled ever darker around the oncoming form. Nathaniel saw a grimace flicker across the mercenary's face, perhaps of doubt or pain. Was his resilience waning? It had already been forced to cope with the shadow's long assault, and now the pestilence beat against it too. Had the skin changed colour? Was it perhaps a little yellowed, a little blotchy? The remorseless steps continued. The pale blue eyes pierced him. Nathaniel pressed back against the stones. Instinctively, his hand closed around the amulet. The metal was cold to the touch. The cloud of pestilence gave a sudden flurry, billowed around the mercenary like a cloak. It was as if it had suddenly found a puncture, a weakness in his armour. It swirled like a storm of hornets enveloping a foe, stinging, stinging. The mercenary kept walking. The skin on his face cracked like old paper. The flesh below fell inward, as if being sucked dry. Colour drained from the jet-black beard. The pale blue eyes stayed fixed upon Nathaniel with consuming hatred. Closer. Closer. The hand that held the knife was shrivelled, nothing but a knot of bones beneath a rind of skin. Now the beard was grey, now it was white. Cheekbones protruded through the hair like jags of slate. To Nathaniel it seemed the mercenary smiled. The smile broadened, displayed impossible extents of teeth. The skin on the face fell away entirely, to leave a gleaming skull with clipped white beard and pale blue eyes, which gave a burst of brightness and suddenly went out. Bones in black clothes. Its step became wholesale collapse. It dropped, splintered, crashed down upon itself, scattering a mess of rags and scraps about Nathaniel's feet. The malignity of the pestilence diminished. What remained of it was sucked away into the amulet as Nathaniel hobbled back across the room. He came to the plinth. Viewed through his lenses, the collective aura of the treasures hurt his eyes. Brightest of all was the staff. He reached out his hand, noting subconsciously the patina of little wounds upon his skin, and picked it up. He recalled at once the smoothness, the lightness of the aged wood. Nathaniel felt no triumph. He was too weak. The staff was in his hand. But the mere notion of activating it daunted him. The pain in his shoulder made him nauseous. He caught sight of the culprit, a bloodied silver disc lying on the tiles. Beside it was a second disc, the one he'd dropped. Stiffly he stooped and placed it in his pocket. The staff? The amulet? Anything more? He considered the array of objects on the plinth. Some, the ones he had heard of, were of no immediate use. Others were gloweringly mysterious, and best left well alone. Without further delay, he departed the Room of Treasures. On his way back through the passages, the guardian shadows, attracted by the pulsing auras of the staff and amulet, attempted to waylay him. Their freezing blue radiance was absorbed by the amulet. Any individuals that flung themselves upon Nathaniel were, in short order, sucked into the piece of jade. Nathaniel was unmolested. As he went, he retrieved the 7-league boots. A few minutes later, he crossed the line of tiles and came out into the entrance room. His scrying glass lay on the desk. "Imp, you have 3 tasks. Then you are free." "You've got to be kidding. One of them's impossible, right? Making a rope of sand? Building a bridge to the other place? Hit me with it. Give me the worst." During the imp's absence, the magician sat slumped upon the desk, supporting himself with the staff. His shoulder throbbed. The skin about his face and hands still burned. His breathing came in fitful gasps. The imp was back. Its face was newly scrubbed and gleaming. It could barely contain its eagerness to be off. "First question. The great spirits are at this very moment leaving the building. Observe." A picture in the depths. Nathaniel recognized the aged front of Westminster Hall. A hole had been blown in the wall. From this issued a cavorting throng, men and women of the government, bounding with awkward, inhuman movements. Detonations flashed, infernos sparked, random bolts of magic plumed and faded. At their heart stalked the short, round figure of Quentin Makepeace. "Off they go," the imp remarked. "About 40-odd, I'd say. Some of them are still a bit uncertain on their feet, like newborn calves. They'll get used to it, I'm sure." Nathaniel sighed. "Very well. Second question, boss. You will find a cache of weapons up the stairs, 3rd door on the left." "Third question?"
"Yes, where is she?"
"Upstairs. Take a right, past the Hall of Statues. Door straight ahead. Here, I can show you if you like."
A picture formed. A Whitehall administrator's study. On the floor, in a pentacle, a girl lay very still.
"Closer in," Nathaniel ordered. "Can you get closer in to her?" "Yep, but it's not pretty." "It is the same girl, mind. Don't think it's not. There, see what I mean? I couldn't be sure at first, but I recognize the clothes."
"Oh, Kitty," Nathaniel said.
Chapter 30. Kitty.
"You took your time," Kitty thought.
"What do you mean? You've only just arrived."
"Rubbish. I've been floating here forever."
They've been all around me, telling me to go, and that I was nothing and shouldn't bother looking, and I began to believe them, Bartimaeus. I was just giving up completely when you came to me just now.
Giving up? You've not been here more than a few seconds. Earth time, that is. It doesn't work the same way on this side. More looped.
I would try to explain it, but hey. The important thing is, you're here. I didn't think you'd come.
It wasn't so difficult. I suppose it was because you helped me through.
It's harder than you know. You're the first since Ptolemy to succeed. It requires the ability to separate from yourself, which is an impossibility for magicians, being what they are. Those who fail go mad.
That's my problem now, that separation. Not being me.
Why don't you try making yourself a guise? Something to focus on. You might feel better.
I've already made some. The only one that worked was a ball, and that seemed to get them angry.
We're not angry. Do I seem angry to you?
Kitty considered the distant flickering image. It was a stately woman, dark-skinned, long-necked, wearing a tall headdress and a long white gown. She sat on a marble throne. Her face was beautiful and serene.
No, she thought, not at all. But you're different.
I don't mean her. That isn't me. It's a memory. I'm all around you. We're all around you. It's not the same as on your side of the gate. There's no difference between the spirits here. We're all one. And that includes you now.
Coils of multiple shades and textures swirled all around as if in confirmation. The image of the woman vanished. Others reappeared. Kitty could see each one a dozen times, as if refracted in an insect's eye. But you knew it was not the images that were multiplied, but herself.
I don't like this much, she thought.
The pictures are memories. Some of them might even be yours.
It is a bit hard to get your head around, I know. Ptolemy found it tricky too, but he perked up when he made himself a shape. Quite artistic it was, a good approximation of himself. Why don't you have another go?
I can do a ball.
I'm not conversing with a ball. Have a bit of confidence.
Kitty steeled herself and applied her will to the surging substances. As before, she managed to create something that approximated a human form. It featured a big wobbly head, a long thin body ending in a triangular mass that might have been a skirt, two stick arms, and a pair of rather trunk-like legs. It had an ungainly look. Several tendrils of matter inspected it tentatively.
"What's that bit?"
"That's an arm."
"Oh, right. That's a relief. Is this how you see yourself, Kitty? There's serious self-esteem issues going on here. Here's a tip. Your real legs aren't quite that thick. Not around the ankles, anyway."
"Tough," Kitty thought. "It's the best I can do."
"Give yourself a face, at least. And for heaven's sake, make it a nice one."
Kitty strove hard and succeeded in forming a couple of piggy eyes, a long witch-like nose, and a mouth crooked in a wonky smile.
"Well, you're no Leonardo."
A brief image flickered on and off close by, a bearded man staring at a wall.
"It would help," Kitty thought savagely, "if I had something to look at other than all this mess."
With an extreme effort, she made her surrogate body jerk an arm out at the swirling matter all around. Some of the curling tendrils recoiled in mock horror.
"You humans are so inconsistent. You claim to love stability and order, but what's Earth if not one big mess? Chaos, violence, dissent and strife, whichever way you look? It's far more peaceful here. But maybe I can help you out. Make things a little easier. Keep control of that lovely body of yours now. I wouldn't want those arm things to fall off. That would ruin its perfection." As Kitty watched, nearby regions of the flowing matter underwent a transformation. Flickering wisps of light elongated, broadened, solidified into planes.
Coils and spirals grew straight and tall, branching out at right angles, joining others and redividing. In moments the semblance of a room had formed around her body. A glassy floor, squared pillars on all sides. Beyond them, steps leading down to a lip, then nothingness. Above was a simple flat roof, also translucent. Beyond the roof, between the pillars, below the floor, the relentless movement of the other place continued unabated. The illusion of a physical space made Kitty suddenly fearful of the void around. Her mannequin cowered in the centre of the room, as far from the verges as possible. "How's that?"
"It's okay. But what about you?"
"I am here. You do not need to see me."
"But I would prefer it."
"Oh, very well. I suppose I am the host." From between the pillars at the end of the hall, a figure stepped. The boy with the ageless face. Where he had been attractive on Earth, here he was resplendently beautiful. His face radiated joy and calm. His skin shone with light and colour. He stepped silently across the floor and came to a halt facing Kitty's wobble-headed, stick-chested, trunk-thighed form. "Thanks," Kitty thought bitterly. "That's made me feel a lot better. It's not actually me, any more than that's you. In fact, you're as much part of this form as I am. There aren't any divisions in the other place."
"It didn't feel that way before you came. They told me I wasn't wanted. Said I was a wound."
"Only because you keep trying to impose order on us, and order means limitations. There should be no limitations here. Nothing definite, nothing defined. Whether it's a clumsy stick figure, or a floating ball, or a house like this." The boy waved a careless arm. "It's alien, and cannot last long. It pains us to be restricted in any fashion." The boy stepped away from her and looked out between two pillars and the rushing lights. Kitty's surrogate tottered after him.
"Bartimaeus?"
"Names, names, names. Now they're the ultimate restriction. They're the worst curse of all. Each one is a sentence of slavery. Here we are one. We have no names. But what do the magicians do? They reach in with their summons. Their words draw us out, piece by screaming piece. As each piece passes through, it is defined. It gains a name and powers of its own, but is separated from the rest. What happens then? Like performing monkeys, we do tricks to please our masters, lest they hurt our fragile essence. Even when we return here, we are never safe. Once a name has been bestowed, we can be called again and yet again, until our essence is worn away." He turned and patted Kitty's semblance on the back of its bulbous head. "You're so disturbed by the connectedness of things here that you prefer to cling to something as unappetizing as this monstrosity, no offence, I'm sure, rather than float freely with us at will. For us on Earth, it is the reverse. Suddenly we are cut off from this fluidity, left alone and vulnerable in a world of vicious definition. By changing shape, we get a little solace, but it never keeps the pain away for long. No wonder some of us become resentful." Kitty had ignored the monologue. She so disliked the crudeness of her creature that she had been stealthily adjusting the size of the head, channeling some of the matter down to plump up her spindly torso. She'd reduced the nose a little too, and made the mouth smaller and less lopsided. Yes, it was markedly better. The boy rolled his eyes. "This is exactly what I mean. You can't get your mind away from the notion that this thing is in some way you. It's nothing but a puppet. Leave it alone." Kitty gave up her attempt to draw out some hair from the back of the creature's head. She turned her full attention on the radiant boy, whose face was suddenly grave. "Why have you come here, Kitty?"
"Because that's what Ptolemy did. I wanted to prove myself, show that I trusted you. You said that after he managed it, you'd have been happy to be his slave. Well, I don't want slaves, but I do need your help, which is why I've come."
The boy's eyes were black crystals full of stars. "In what way do you wish my help?"
"You know why. Those spirits that have broken free. They plan to fall on London, kill its people."
"Haven't they yet?" the boy remarked casually. "They are being slow about it. Don't be cruel." In her agitation, Kitty's creature swung its stick arms above its head and lurched forward across the hall. The boy stepped back in surprise. "Most of the people in London are innocent. They don't want the magicians any more than you do." "I'm asking you on their account, Bartimaeus. It's they who are going to suffer when Nauda's army gets loose." The boy nodded sadly. "Fakwal and Nauda are sick. It's what happens to some of us when we're summoned many times. Slavery corrupts us. Our personalities become brutalized, dull, vindictive. We dwell far more on trivial indignities suffered in your world than on the wonders and pleasures of this place. Hard to believe, but true." Kitty looked out at the flashes of light and the infinity of moving essence. "What do you actually do here?" she asked. "It's not about doing. It's about being. Don't expect to understand it. You're a human. You can only see surfaces. And then you want to impose yourself upon them. And Fakwal and Nauda and the rest have been twisted in your image. They define themselves now by their hatred. It's so strong they actually want to be apart from this, providing they can take revenge. In a way, it's a final capitulation to the values of your world. Hey, you're getting better at manipulating that thing." Shielded from the full energies of the other place, Kitty was finding it easier to make her mannequin move about. It strutted to and fro about the little hall, swinging its arms and moving its balloon head jerkily from side to side, as if acknowledging an audience. The boy nodded with approval. "You know, it's almost an improvement on your real self." Kitty ignored this. The mannequin stopped at the boy's side. "I've done what Ptolemy did," she thought. "I've proved myself to you, and you answered my call. You've acknowledged it. Now I need your help to stop what what Fakwal and Nauda are doing." The boy smiled. "Your sacrifice is indeed great. And in Ptolemy's memory, I would be pleased to return the gesture. But there are two problems that prevent it. First, you'd have to summon me back to Earth. And that may be beyond you now." "Why?" Kitty asked. The boy was looking at her with a gentle, almost kindly expression. It unnerved her. "Why?" she asked again. "The second problem," the boy went on, "is my unfortunate weakness. I haven't been here long enough to rebuild my energies fully, and Fakwal, let alone Nauda, has more power in one of his big toes than I do right at this moment. I'm disinclined to enter into slavery that is guaranteed to be fatal. I'm sorry, but there it is." "It won't be slavery. I told you that before." The mannequin stretched out an arm toward the boy in a hesitant gesture. "But it would be fatal." Kitty's mannequin lowered its arm. "Okay. What if we had the staff?"
"Gladstone's? How?
Who'd use it? You couldn't."
"Nathaniel's trying to get hold of it right now."
"All very well, but could he use—"
"Wait a minute."
The radiant features of the boy contorted, slipped out of true, as if the controlling intelligence had drawn back in shock. An instant later, they were as perfect as before.
"Let's get this straight. He told you his name?" "Yes. Now, I like that. I like that. He's been giving me gyp for years, simply because I could have spilled the beans, and now he's telling any old broad he meets free of charge. Who else knows? Fakwal? Nauda? Did he deck his name out in neon lights and parade it round the town? I ask you. And I never told anyone.
You let it slip last time I summoned you."
"Well, apart from that." "But you could have told his enemies, couldn't you, Bartimaeus? You'd have found a way to harm him if you really wished it. And Nathaniel knows that too, I think. I had a talk with him."
The boy looked thoughtful. "I know all about those talks of yours."
"Anyway, he's gone for the staff. I went to find you. Together,
the long and the short of it is that none of us are up to a fight. Not any more. You won't be, for starters. As for Mandrake, last time he tried to use the staff, he knocked himself out. What makes you think he'll have the strength to do it now? He was exhausted last time I saw him. Meanwhile, my essence is so shot, I couldn't maintain a simple form on Earth, let alone be useful. I probably couldn't even withstand the pain of materializing in the first place. Fakwal's got one thing right. He doesn't have to worry about the pain. No, let's face facts, Kitty. A pause. What? What's the matter? The mannequin had tilted its bulbous head and was regarding the boy with an air of quiet intentness. The boy became uneasy. What? What are you... Oh, no. Absolutely no way.
But, Bartimaeus, it would protect your essence. You wouldn't feel any pain.
Uh-uh. No.
And if you combined your power with his, maybe the staff...
No.
What would Ptolemy have done?
The boy turned away. He crossed to the nearest pillar and sat down on the steps, looking out over the swirling void. Ptolemy showed me the way it might have been, he remarked at last. He thought he would be the first of many. But in 2,000 years, you, Kitty, are the only one who's followed him. The only one. He and I conversed as equals for 2 years. I helped him out from time to time. In return, he let me explore your world a little. I wandered as far as the Fazan Oasis and the pillared halls of Axum. I floated over the white crests of the Zagros Mountains and the dry stone gulches of the Hejaz Deserts. I flew with the hawks and the cirrus clouds, high, high over earth and sea, and took with me memories of those places when I returned home. As he spoke, little flickering images danced beyond the pillars of the hall. Kitty could not make them out, but she had little doubt they showed fragments of the wonders he had seen. She sent her mannequin to sit beside him on the step. Their legs dangled out over nothingness. "The experience," the boy continued, "was exhilarating. My freedom echoed that of my home, while my interest was roused by what I saw. The pain I felt was never too pressing, since I was able to return here when I wished. How I danced between the worlds! It was a great gift that Ptolemy gave me, and I have never forgotten it. I knew him for 2 years, and then he died."
"How?" Kitty asked. "How did he die?"
At first no answer came. Then, "Ptolemy had a cousin, the heir to the throne of Egypt. He feared my master's power. Several times he attempted to get rid of him, but we, the other djinn and I, stood in his way." Out among the swirling matter, Kitty glimpsed recurring images of more than usual clarity. Figures crouching on a window ledge, holding long curved swords. Demons flitting over nighttime roofs. Soldiers at a door. "I would have taken him from Alexandria, particularly after his journey here had rendered him more vulnerable. But he was stubborn. He refused to go, even when Roman magicians arrived in the city and were housed by his cousin in the palace citadel." Brief flashes in the void, sharp triangular sails, ships below a lighthouse tower, 6 pale men in coarse brown cloaks, standing on a quay. "It pleased my master," the boy went on, "to be carried about the city most mornings, to let the scents of the markets drift over him, the spices, flowers, resins, hides, and skins. All the world was present in Alexandria, and he knew it. Besides, the people loved him. My fellow djinn and I carried him in his palanquin." Here Kitty caught the suggestion of a curtained chair, suspended on poles. Dark slaves supported it. Behind were stalls and people, bright things, blue sky. The images winked out. The boy sat silent on the step. "One day," he continued, "we took him to the spice market, his favourite place, where the scents were most intoxicating. We were foolish to do so. The streets were narrow, clogged with people. Progress was slow." Kitty saw a long, low stall, studded with racks of wooden boxes, each filled with coloured spice. A barrel-maker sat cross-legged before an open door, fixing struts into a metal ring. Other images came and went, houses painted white, goats milling among crowds, children fixed mid-run. The chair again, its curtains shut. "In the centre of the market, I spotted something moving on a roof up ahead. I gave my pole to Penrhyn Nwtet, became a bird, rose up to check. Above the roofs I saw. He broke off. The fabric of the other place was black as syrup. It swirled angrily, slowly, lit by lightning flashes. An image lingered. Rooftops stretching away, bleached bone-white by a dazzling sun. Across the sky, dark figures hung in silhouette. Great wings spread, long tails outstretched. Here and there, light glinted on armoured scales. Now Kitty saw horrors. A snake's head, a wolf's snout, a skinless face with bared teeth grinning. The picture vanished. The Roman magicians had summoned many djinn. Afreets, too. They came at us from all sides. We were four djinn. What could we do? We stood and fought. There in the street, among the people, we stood and fought for him. A final confusion of images, rapidly changing and out of focus. Smoke, explosions, blue-green energies, crackling up and down a narrow lane. Humans screaming. The demon with the skinless face falling from the sky, clawing at a hole in the center of its torso. Other djinn, too. One had a hippo's head, one an ibis's bill, standing close beside the curtained chair. Afa died first, the boy continued, then Penranutit and Teti. I threw up a shield, snatched Ptolemy away. I broke through the wall, killed those who pursued me, fled across the sky. They came after us like a swarm of bees. What happened? Kitty asked. The boy had fallen silent once again. No images appeared in the void. I was caught by a detonation. Wounded. Couldn't fly. Broke into a little temple. Barricaded us in. Ptolemy was in bad shape. Worse, I mean, than he had been before. I think it was the smoke or something. The enemy surrounded the temple. There was no way out.
And then?
I cannot speak of it. He gave me a final gift. That is the essence of the matter. The boy shrugged, then. He looked across at Kitty's mannequin for the first time. Poor Ptolemy. He thought his example might help to reconcile our kinds. He was convinced the account of his journey would be read and followed down the centuries and lead to a union of worlds. He told me so right here. Well, for all his light and clarity, he was completely wrong. He died, and his ideas have been forgotten. Kitty's creature frowned.
How can you say that, when I'm here too? And Nathaniel's read his book, and Mr. Button,
and the Apocrypha's only fragments. He never survived to write the rest. Besides, people like Nathaniel read, but they don't believe.
I believed.
Yes, you did.
If you come back and help save London, you will be continuing Ptolemy's work. Humans and djinn, working together. That's what he wanted, isn't it?
The boy looked out at the void. Ptolemy made no demands on me.
I'm not making any demands either. You can do what you wish. I'm asking for your help. If you don't want to respond, that's fine.
Well... The boy stretched out his thin brown arms. It's against my better judgment, but it would be nice to settle scores with Fakwal. We'd need the staff, mind. Useless without the staff. And I'm not staying long, especially if I'm cooped up in—
Thank you, Bartimaeus.
In a swell of gratitude, Kitty's mannequin leaned across and flopped its stick arms out around the boy's neck. The bulbous head rested briefly against his slim dark one.
All right, all right. Don't get soppy. You've made your sacrifice.
Now I suppose it's my turn. Firmly, but with restraint, the boy extricated himself from the mess of limbs and stood upon the step. You'd better get back, he said, before it's too late. The mannequin looked up, head twisted accusingly, then sprang to its feet in a fury.
What do you mean, exactly? You keep saying this. What sacrifice?
I thought you knew. I'm sorry.
What? I'm going to thump you in a minute.
How? You haven't any hands.
Or I'll push you off the edge. Just tell me.
The truth is, Kitty, the other place is not conducive to humans. In the same way that my essence suffers on Earth, so your essence suffers here.
Meaning?
meaning you have willfully separated yourself from your body. Not for too long, which is to your advantage. Ptolemy stayed far longer, asking questions, always asking questions. He was here twice the time that you have been, but...
But? Come on!
The mannequin leapt forward, arms outstretched, head thrust out aggressively. The boy stepped back to the final step, teetering on the edge of the void.
Don't you see how good you're becoming at maneuvering that thing? You were hopeless at first. Already you're forgetting your earthly ties. When Ptolemy got back, he'd forgotten almost everything. He couldn't walk, could barely use his limbs. Took him all his strength, even to summon me again. And that's not all. While you're here, back on Earth, your body's busy dying. Can't really blame it, can you? It's been abandoned. Better get back fast, Kitty. Better get back fast.
But how? She whispered. I don't know how.
Fear flooded her. Her mannequin, her bubble-headed creature, stood disconsolate on the step. The boy smiled, stepped forward, and kissed it on the forehead.
That's easy, Bartimaeus said. The gate's still open. I can dismiss you. Relax. Work's over. You've done your bit.
He stepped away. The mannequin, the boy, and the pillared hall exploded into wisps and trails. Kitty burst across the maelstrom of the other place, among the lights and whirling colours. She drifted, drifted. All around her was the weightlessness of death.
Part 5. Alexandria, 124 BC. Bartimaeus.
A hop, a limp. We fell up the steps between the columns. Ahead of us, a door of bronze, green with age. I shoved it open, pitched forward into the sanctuary of the god. Cool, dank air, no windows. I pushed the door shut and slammed fast an ancient bolt. Even as I did so, something collided against the other side. I put a seal upon the door for neatness' sake, then sent a wisp light flaring against the ceiling, where it hummed and flickered with a pinkish glow. At the end of the room, a metal statue of a bearded cove looked at us with grave disapproval. Beyond the door and all around the sanctuary came the thwack of leather wings. I laid my master beneath the wisp light and bent my muzzle close. His breathing came erratically. Blood seeped against his clothes. His ravaged face, all wheals and wrinkles, like an ancient fruit, was bleached of colour. His eyes opened. He raised himself on one arm.
"Steady," I said. "Save your strength."
"I don't need to, Bartimaeus," he said, using my true name. "Not any more."
The lion gave a growl. "None of that talk," I said. "This is called tactics. We're having a rest. I'll break us out of here in a minute."
He coughed. Blood came up.
"To be honest, I don't think I could take another of your flights."
"Oh, go on. It'll be even more interesting with just one wing. Think you could flap an arm?"
"No. What happened?"
"It was this stupid mane. I didn't see that jinni coming from the side. He ambushed us, got me with a detonation. That's the last time I wear one as bushy as this."
There was a small grating up near the top of the old smooth wall. Several shadows wheeled across its strips of light. Something heavy landed on the roof above. Ptolemy cursed softly under his breath. The lion frowned.
"What?"
"Back at the market. I dropped the parchment. My notes on the other place."
I sighed. I could sense the movement all around. The click-clack of claw on stone, the small skitterings of scales across the roof tiles. I could hear the whisperings in Latin. I visualized them, clinging to every surface of the building like giant flies.
"That's unfortunate," I said, "but it's not our main concern."
"I've not finished my account," he whispered. "Nothing's left in my rooms but fragments."
"Ptolemy, it doesn't matter."
"But it does. This was going to make things different. It was going to change the way magicians worked. It was going to end your slavery."
The lion looked down at him. "Let's be frank," I said. "My slavery and my life are going to end in, approximately 2 minutes." He frowned.
Not so, Bartimaeus.
The walls echoed to the muffled sound of blows. Yes, so.
I can't get out, but you can.
With this wing, you must be. Ah, I see. The lion shook its head. Not a chance.
I'm technically your master, don't forget. I say you can go. I say you will go.
By way of reply, I rose, stood in the centre of the little temple, and let out a roar of defiance. The building shook. For a couple of seconds afterward, all activity outside was stilled. Then it industriously resumed again. I snapped my teeth together nastily. In a few moments, I said, they're going to break through, and when they do, they'll learn to fear the power of Bartimaeus of Uruk. Anyhow, who knows? I've taken out 6 djinn at once before now.
And how many are out there?
Oh, about 20.
Right. That settles it.
With shaking arms, the boy rose to a sitting position.
Help me lean back against that wall. Come on, come on. Do you want me to die lying down?
The lion did as he was bid, then straightened. I took up my post facing the door, which in the centre was glowing red with an intense heat and beginning to bulge a little. "Don't ask again," I said. "I'm not shifting."
"Oh, I won't ask, Bartimaeus."
Something in his tone made me swivel round. I saw Ptolemy grinning lopsided at me, one hand raised. I reached toward him. "Don't!" He snapped his fingers, spoke the dismissal words. Even as he did so, the door exploded in a shower of molten metal. 3 tall figures sprang into the room. Ptolemy gave me a small salute. Then his head fell back gently against the wall. I rotated toward the enemy and raised a paw to smite them, but my substance had become diffuse like smoke. Despite my most desperate urgings, I could do nothing to hold it firm. All light around me vanished, my consciousness departed, the other place pulled me away. Furiously, against my will, I accepted Ptolemy's last gift. Chapter 31 Kitty. The first feeling was that of terrible constriction. With the sudden act of waking, her infinite dimensions were all at once reduced to a single point. She was compressed back down to the margins of her body, tangled up within its lumpen weight. A moment of suffocation, the hideous sensation of being buried alive, then she remembered how to breathe. She lay in darkness, hearing the rhythms within her. The blood moving, the air wheezing back and forth, the bubbles shifting and gurgling in stomach and bowels. She'd never realized before quite how noisy she was, how heavy, how densely packed. It seemed an appalling complexity, and one that would be quite impossible to operate. The idea of moving it mystified her. Gradually the confusion resolved itself into vague recognition of the contours of her limbs. The knees drawn up almost to her waist, the feet gently overlapping each other, the hands clasped close against her breast. She visualized it in her head, and with this, a sensation of affection and gratitude for her body came flooding through her. It warmed her. Awareness grew. She sensed the hardness of the surface on which she lay, the softness of the cushion pillowing her head. She remembered where she was. And where she had been. Kitty opened her eyes. Everything was blurred. For a second the swimming lines of light and shadow beguiled her. She thought she was drifting in the other place again. Then she steadied herself and concentrated, and slowly, grudgingly, the lines snagged and stopped and yielded up a picture of a person sitting in a chair. He sat in a posture of extreme exhaustion. His head had slumped sideways. His legs lolled left and right. She heard the rasping of his breath. His eyes were closed. A chain hung about his neck. At its end was an oval piece of gold, centred with a green-black stone. It rose and fell with the rhythmic movement of his chest. Between his knees a long wooden staff rested at an acute diagonal. One hand was cupped loosely to support it. The other hung limply over the chair arm. After a while, she remembered his name.
Nathaniel?
Her voice was so faint, she could not be sure whether she had actually made a noise, or only sounded the word in her head. Nevertheless, it seemed to work. A grunt, a splutter. The magician's legs and arms jerked as if electrically charged. The staff fell to the floor. With something midway between a leap and a plunge, he was crouching at her side. She tried to smile. It was hard. Her face hurt.
"Hello,"
she said. The magician didn't answer. He just stared.
"You got the staff, then?"
she said, and,
"My throat's dry. Got any water?"
Still no reply. His skin, she noticed, was red and chafed, as if he had been out in a high wind. He was gazing at her with extreme attention, yet still contriving to ignore her words completely. Kitty became irritated.
"Move out the way," she snapped. "I'm getting up."
She tensed her stomach muscles, moved an arm, and pressed her fingers to the floor to push herself up. An object fell from her grasp with a dull clang. A wave of nausea filled her. Her muscles felt like water. Kitty's head fell back upon the cushion. Something about her weakness scared her.
"Nathaniel,"
she began.
"What?"
He spoke for the first time.
"It's all right. Just rest there." "I want to get up."
"I really don't think you should."
"Help me up!"
The fury was fueled by anxiety, blossoming into sudden terror. The weakness was all wrong.
"I'm not lying here. What is it? What's happened to me?"
"You'll be fine if you just stay put." His tone was unconvincing. She tried again, pushed herself up a little, collapsed with a curse. The magician swore in tandem.
"All right. Here. I'll try to support your back. Don't try and take your weight. Your legs will... There. What did I tell you? Do what I say for once."
He grasped her beneath her arms, lifted her up and swung her round, hauling her toward the chair. Her legs trailed behind her, her feet scraped across the lines of the pentacle. With scant ceremony, Kitty found herself dumped in a sitting position. The magician stood facing her, breathing hard.
"Happy now?"
he said.
"Not really. What's happened to me? Why can't I walk?"
"They're not questions I can answer." He stared at his boots, large, scuffed leather ones, and across at the empty circle.
"When I broke in, Kitty," he said, "the room was icy cold. I couldn't find a pulse on you, and you weren't breathing, just lying there. I thought you were... I really thought you were dead this time. Instead..."
He raised his eyes.
"So, tell me, did you really?"
She looked at him for a time without speaking. The tension in the magician's face loosened into blank astonishment. He exhaled slowly and half sat, half slumped against the desk.
"I see," he said. "I see."
Kitty cleared her throat.
"I'll tell you in a minute. First, pass me that mirror, would you?"
"I don't think. I'd rather look," she said crisply, "than use my imagination.
So hurry it up. We've got things to do."
No amount of argument could dissuade her.
"After all," she said at last, "it's nothing very different to what happened to Jacob with the black tumbler. And he was fine."
"That's true." The magician's hands were growing tired. He adjusted the position of the mirror.
"I can dye the hair."
"Yes."
"And as for the rest, I'll kind of grow into it."
"Yes."
"In about 50 years.
"It's just lines, Kitty."
"Just lines? Lots of people have them. Besides, they might fade."
"You think?"
"Yes. They look a lot less bad already than when I first found you."
"Really?"
"Definitely. Anyway, look at me. Check out these blisters." "I was meaning to ask about them."
"Pestilence did it. When I got the staff."
"Oh. But it's the weakness that really scares me, Nathaniel. What if I never—"
"You will. Look at you waving your hands about. You weren't doing that 5 minutes ago."
"Wasn't I? Oh, good. Now you mention it, I do feel a little stronger."
"There you go, you see."
"But it's just so difficult," she said, to look in the mirror and see a different face, to see that everything's changed.
"Not everything," he said.
"No?"
"No."